It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2023, returning MOI Global instructor, Stephen Gorelick. Stephen, in addition to being head of research at Firebird Management, is also the lead fund manager of Firebird US Value Fund, as well as portfolio manager of Firebird's Eastern Europe and Russia funds. He joined Firebird in 2005 from Columbia University Graduate School of Business while completing education from a highly selective value investing program. Prior to business school, Steve was an operational strategy consultant at Deloitte, working with companies in various industries, including banking, healthcare, and retail. He holds a BS degree from Carnegie Mellon University, as well as a CFA charter and a membership in Beta Gamma Sigma Honor Society. Steve serves on a number of supervisory boards of listed and private companies in the Baltics. He speaks Russian, English, as well as his native Belarusian. Steve, always enjoy your presentations. I know they've been of great value to the community, and so I look forward to what you have prepared for us today. I will now turn it to you. Please go ahead.
John, thank you so much for that kind presentation, and thanks for once again allowing me to present to the MOI Global's audience. Over the years, I've had a number of fantastic interactions with the people, both as a result of presentations and as a result of me contacting people based on their presentations. And I want to thank you once again for building such a wonderful community. In terms of what we're going to talk about today, John did mention that Firebird invests in Eastern Europe and we have a US fund. While there's a lot of interesting things to discuss in Eastern Europe, I did think that from a point of view of actionable market opportunity, what's going to be more interesting to discuss today would be the US market, how we approach the US market and the specific opportunities that we see there. Starting out, first, I wanted to talk about last year, 2022, which was unusual in a lot of ways. The market has been down. The market ended up down 18%. We don't often see the benchmark down double digits. Even less so, we see it in the environment when both equities and bonds are down about the same. So whether you were invested in equities, whether you invested in bonds, chances are you experienced losses of capital last year. And it was kind of a difficult year to be an investor. And it seems like the reason for it has been the interest rates going up from ultra low levels that we've been experiencing over most of the last decade to a level that is a little more normal from a historical perspective. If we're going back to not just last 10 years, but last 30, 40, 50 years, the level of interest rates that we're experiencing today, which, 3, 4, 5%, that is what we usually see, not the 0% that we've seen for most of the last decade. And despite the talk of anticipated inflation and not an anticipated recession and potential economic difficulties in US and globally, I think, and from what the data is showing us, that most of the market action that we saw last year could be explained just by the change in interest rates. And the reason why I'm saying that is because if we, one of the things that we look at is the what happens, what can you make from investing into the stock market once you normalize historical results over the last, let's say, 12 years, just push them forward without much analysis on top of that. What would happen if you keep the operating margins the same as they were on average? What would happen if you keep the growth about the same, average multiple, et cetera? Based on that, it looks like the expected returns for the market over the course of 22 went up from about 3% to about 6%. And that change of about 3% is about the same changes as what we saw in the risk-free interest rates and also in the higher quality bonds as well. So from the point of view of if we're looking at the equity returns is a function of the opportunity costs of safer investments, that opportunity cost went up last year. And that suggests that that was the main reason for what we saw as market action in 22. When we look at 2023, what's going to happen to the interest rates is truly anybody's guess. Some people expect them to go up. Some people expect them to go down because there is expectations of a recession. Some people expect it to stay the same. So if we compare back to, I think it was in 2019, when interest rates, in the beginning of the year, most people expected interest rates to go up because the economy was quite strong. Over the course of the years, they actually went down because of the weakness, kind of emerging weaknesses even before COVID. That was not expected. That was not a thing that was expected by a lot of analysts in the beginning of 2019. Right now, what we're seeing is a lot more balanced approach to what's going to be happening in the future. And this is not something that we in any way at Firebird try to predict, because we do think that this is one of the more efficient corners of the markets out there because of how many people are trying to opine on what's going to happen to interest rates, either going up or going down. Where we do see a risk for the market in 2023 is the assumptions on corporate profitability. And that is independent of whether we're going to see a recession or not. The level of operating profitability that companies in US are experiencing right now is very high by historical standards. There's a few reasons for it, some of which are sustainable. So for example, the lower tax rate that we've enjoyed over the last 10 years or so, that is a reason, a real reason for the net margins to be higher. We don't know whether it's sustainable going forward, but at least you can explain that as something that is there and that is explained. Other factors that are a little more fluffy, I would say, like you can have corporate efficiencies, you can have higher productivity, et cetera. So those factors have contributed to higher operating margins for the companies in the United States, but also they could be competed away. And historically, they did fluctuate. They never just went up and up and up. There was a period in, I think, in the 60s and in the 80s. And if you go back even further, there were periods when the operating margins were going up, but then they were going down as the competition intensified. We may see something like that again. I think one of the reasons why I'm bringing it up as a issue for 2023, it's not so much of the level that where we are right now, but also what is happening to the projections, the analyst projections. And it seems like more often than not, people expecting those margins to continue to expand. And meanwhile, we do have higher inflation. Higher inflation historically does have a negative correlation with operating margins. That does make sense, because not every business has pricing power to be able to just increase their prices in line with the costs. So operating margins usually shrink in time of inflation. We could have a recession. And to make a bet that the margins will continue to stay up at the levels where they are, where they have been over the last couple of years, is not something that we would feel comfortable with. Another thing that I would mention is that if we're looking at analyst estimates for the margins in 2023, if we go back a year, in the beginning of 22, those we look at operating cash flow margins, and those were expected to be at around 19% for the year that just started, 2023. As we actually entering the year, those expectations came down quite a bit, from 19% to a little over 18. So from about over 19% to a little over 18%. But the historical average is 16. And it's if we do see some economic turmoil, it's very plausible that we will end up somewhere around historical averages or even lower. And that is something that I don't think the market is prepared for. And that would have a real impact on the equity valuations in the United States this year. So I would say coming into the year, we are neutral to cautious to where the market is. And the question is, what do we look for within this type of environment? And I've been discussing the topic of inflection points a couple of times before at the MOI events. And that to me is something that is an area that is especially important at the time when you don't really know what's going to be happening to the market. Because if you can get an operating inflection point correctly, then that company should do well independent of market environment, because it was usually the inflection point starts from some kind of temporary difference, that temporary difficulty that is experienced by a company. And if that difficulty is resolved, then what you see is, first of all, you see an improvement in operating results. It could be returned to higher growth rates that were there before. It could be returned to better margins that they had before. But what's more importantly is that you see the multiple at which the market is valuing this business, usually expense as well, because what you see is you see people getting more comfortable with projecting better results going forward and being offering a higher multiple for this company. So you as an investor get to enjoy the double benefit. First of all, the benefit of operating results improving, and second, the benefit from a higher multiple. So kind of like a coiled spring effect that happens. There's a couple of examples from the past that I wanted to mention where we did see investing in inflection points truly work out for the investors, and that really did not depend that much on operating environment. First example is Chipotle, and this is going back a bit, I think at this point is 6 years. When the company had real issues, I don't know if you guys remember this or not, but this the company was focused on a few food safety scandals. Company before that was truly a darling of the market, one of the better returns on investor capital in the QSR space. And this is a company that went from being very profitable to about break even in a very short period of time because of the fall in food traffic that they experienced. What we saw looking at the situation is that we saw that most of the costs for Chipotle were actually fixed. If you think about it, that makes sense. You have the food costs, but as far as the labor, the cost of running a restaurant, et cetera, most of the costs were pretty much fixed. And the reason why the margins went down so much is because they had a relatively small fall in food traffic, relatively small fall in like-for-likes. And that caused a significant drop in operating profitability for the business. And what we also saw is analysts continuing to kind of projecting that forward and saying that, well, the margins are, the sales might recover, but overwhelming opinion was that the margins will stay at about the same lower levels where they were when sales were down. Looking at the situation, we thought that it was really intriguing, and we got really excited about the idea when the new CEO came in, and his comp package was specifically targeted towards the operating margins improving, and improving exactly to the point where they were before. And this was something that we saw, that if the sales improved just about 10%, they didn't have to increase that much, we could see the operating margins increase dramatically. This is exactly what happened. The company has executed very well. And over the next 4 years, while the sales only grew 50%, EBITDA of the company has increased 6 times and the stock went up 8 times. So this was an example of an inflection point, an operating inflection point, where because the company had relatively fixed cost base, slight improvement in sales could have a dramatic improvement on the company's results and valuation. Another example is a little more recent, is a company called Arista Networks. And I think it was in 2019, and before that, so what Arista does is they make high-end switching equipment mostly for data centers. So their biggest customers are all of the cloud providers like Google, Amazon, Microsoft of the world. They do other things as well, but those are the major customers. And back in 2019, there was this very interesting period where the company before that was growing really year over year, 30% almost every year in its history, really phenomenal company, very profitable. They said that their sales are going to slow down for about a year or so. And the reason for it was because their major customers were taking a pause in purchasing decisions. And in order to kind of think about how to design the next generation of data centers and cloud storage, given the higher capacity needs and higher data needs that we're all, you know, experiencing on a daily basis. The market took the stock down by about 50% because most of the investors were used to growth rates of 30% plus. And the company was saying, well, we'll grow in low single digits for the next year. Investors weren't comfortable with it. But what we saw is the company discussing things. And what really gave us comfort with the idea is that Arista engineers were actively involved in those design decisions for the data centers. So it wasn't the situation that the demand for companies' products was permanently going away. I mean, data storage needs are increasing exponentially. So we felt comfortable with that there's going to be need for more and more data centers going forward. We felt comfortable that Arista is going to be part of the solution because their engineers are involved within those designing the solutions, and also they have best-in-class products. And meanwhile, the company has just become significantly cheaper, not because the operating results went down, but because the market multiple went down quite a bit. So we got involved in that company during that time. After 2019, there was 2020 and COVID. So the first half of the year, nobody was making significant investment decisions either. But then after that, the demand for the Arista products has exploded and continued to be very strong. Their sales grew by 25% or something like that in 21, and on pace to grow at 35% or 40% in 22. They still haven't reported those results. And once again, we saw a improvement in companies' sales. We saw slight improvement in EBITDA margins. Those margins stayed pretty high to start with. So as their sales never fell that much, so the margins stayed about the same. But then as the sales growth came back, EBITDA margins have continued to expand. And also the stock reacting phenomenally well to that, with shares up being three times over since the March 2020 lows. And moreover, kind of even last year, when most of the tech did not perform well, Arista shares still did reasonably well. I mean, they weren't down. I think they were down a little bit, but not that much. So this kind of shows that how high of a quality this company is. So kind of within looking for the inflection points, we have developed a few, a small checklist in terms of what we're looking for. And those things are essential because without it, there is, you know, it's very difficult to make money especially within the type of environment that we're finding ourselves in. First, and it's very important, is the underlying demand for product growing. Because if the pie is expanding, then there's a lot more room for error. There's a lot more room for companies to be able to take the time to execute and to get better. So that's one of the things that we're looking for, to make sure that the underlying demand for the product is growing. And then the second one is taking a look at what the market thinks about the company. You can see that from the analyst expectations. You can see what is from ratings. You can see that from what is being projected. And usually, more often than not, what you see is analysts really projecting the past few data points into the future, as opposed to looking for these inflection points, which do happen with some businesses. So that's not a thing that we analyze. And the third is that we try to find a catalyst in terms of what is going to change and why. So an example of Arista, it was kind of that pause had a time limit to it. Like, we knew that if it is truly a pause, then after a year or so, the demand will come back. With Chipotle, it did seem that, okay, once the food safety scandals are in the rearview mirror, then the company should, sales should be recovering and margins should be recovering as well. So if you can identify the catalyst that will lead to a change in sentiment, you can get comfortable with investing in an inflection point. So the company I'm going to talk about today is Medifast. It's a weight loss management company. It's a multi-level marketing company, which I know is almost a curse word in investing circles in a lot of places. But I do think that this company is slightly different, and I will talk about it in a little bit. It has about $1.2 billion market cap, a little bit of net cash, there's no debt, daily trading volume about $14 million. This company has been doing kind of similar to Arista's story, is used to growing 30% per year, year over year over year, up until last year, and 21 was a very strong year for them. And 22 was a year when sales growth has slowed down. The sales are still growing, but they'd slowed down to kind of single digit levels. And the stock price was cut by more than half, I think, during that year. So what is the Medifast model? They sell weight management. They sell weight management solution through meal replacements. Depending on, they have different programs. In kind of the most intensive program, they expect the customers to pretty much replace almost all of their meals with it's called 5+1. So five meals is these fuelings, and one is a regular meal. So they expect it to replace almost all of your calorie intake through these fuelings, which are kind of this balanced, lower calorie, but balanced supplement that has proteins and vitamins, et cetera. So it's a meal replacement program. And what is very important is that it is a meal replacement program that comes with a system of support through the coaches that are selling you these products. So these people, unlike other companies like Herbalife, you have people that the coaches there are there to are trained to support you in your journey, a weight loss journey, and also and can then they get paid for it by selling you these additional products. Another thing that's very important to mention that currently the Medifast products are only sold in North America. Historically, the growth of this company has been coming as a result of growth in the number of coaches. It grows by about 33% per annum, admittedly from a relatively small base. The key difference in the coaching model with Herbalife model is that coaches don't hold inventory. With Herbalife, the way that the distributors there make money is that they take inventory and then they resell their premium to their customers. And other people may choose to sell to the same customers a slightly lower premium, and you take inventory risk. And there's problems with online sites being set up selling Herbalife products. So there's a lot of, okay, from an incentive point of view for other MLM schemes like Herbalife, those have a lot of issues that Medifast seemingly solved through a coaching model. You can only buy, the fuelings that are being bought. They're being bought through a special link that is provided by the coach. Coach does not take inventory, and they can, you know, depending on number of clients that they have, it could be a lifestyle kind of income supplement type of situation, or some people do make it their primary job. The number of Medifast, and the main product there is Optavia. So the number of Optavia coaches has been growing by about 30% per annum, as I already mentioned. But also the number of coaches that are making $5,000 per year or more is also has been growing nicely. So this is not a network where a few people at the top make most of the money. I mean, that is, you do have that. So from a point of view of number of people that are making more than $100,000 a year, that number is not very high. But in terms of number of making reasonable money, like $5,000 per year, that number has been growing nicely. So that is truly that those commissions for the coaches do become very relevant, especially in times like we're seeing today, where the inflation of our everyday products is going up quite a bit. And so those coach commissions are the main cost for Medifast. So, and 70% of their costs are variable. So it's coach commissions and cost of goods sold represent together 70%, and those costs are completely variable. They on top of the other costs are like SG&A, those are fixed. Those have been coming down as percent of sales consistently because they're not growing as fast as the sales. And what the company has been doing, they have been keeping the operating margin the same, but have been increasing the coaching commissions a bit as percent of sales. So kind of providing more incentives to the coaches, which gets them more coaches, and really kind of building a virtuous circle on top of that, while maintaining margins at a very reasonable level of about, you know, mid-teens, Those have been steady, and the company feels very, and most importantly, you know, if the sales do fall, then the company can very easily cut a big chunk of their costs because they're mostly variable. The addressable market, unfortunately, is huge. In US, I mean, I couldn't believe this statistic myself, but more than 70% of people in US are considered overweight or obese. And that number has increased from, in terms of obesity, from 14% in 1960 to 50% plus. So just over a period of 50 years, the number of people with weight issues has increased dramatically. And you're talking hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. From that point of view, like the number of people that Medifast has right now, number of customers has right now, which is I think it's a little over a million, it just shows you that how big the addressable market is. And moreover, the idea of direct selling within the weight loss market does make sense. And if you take a look at a company like Medifast or Weight Watchers, it's not so much that selling your product. In order for it, you also need to be sold a lifestyle. You need to also be sold support, because that's the way that you can lose weight and keep it off. And that's where I do think where Medifast idea with coaches, not just distributors, but coaches, does make a lot of sense. And that's why I think it has been really successful. Also, if you take a look at the number of people involved in direct selling in the United States, that number I also couldn't believe myself. It's almost 7 million people in the US are involved in some kind of direct selling. It could be weight loss, it could be Tupperware, it could be beauty products, but the number of people involved in direct selling is a lot. Those people are entrepreneurial, and they may switch from selling, let's say, a cosmetic to a weight loss product because if they see a better opportunity within that. And just from, I'm going to go back once a couple of slides, but our current number of Optavia coaches is 60,000. Total number of people involved in direct selling in the United States is 6.8 million. So that just shows you that from a point of view of the amount of potential growth that the company has is out there. Even the number of people involved in selling Herbalife is double that of Medifast. So where would the inflection point come from? In 22, what we saw is we saw a slowdown in sales. And the reason why that happened actually makes a lot of sense is because in 21, people were still, most of the population was still facing the effects of COVID. And within that, people were at home, some people were thinking about their health, and you did have a pretty serious growth for Optavia and Medifast within 21. In 22, people finally got a chance in the United States to enjoy life for the first time in a couple of years, which meant going out to restaurants, which meant traveling. You don't necessarily think about losing weight within that time. You want to enjoy life a little bit. And that to us was the main reason for the slowdown, both in number in the growth in coaches, which still continued to increase last year, but also in sales per coach. So it became a little more difficult for the coaches to recruit the clients. But meanwhile, the problem with weight is still out there. And I do think that as we are moving forward into 2023, you know, the base effect of a high 21 goes away. And what we will see is that much easier comparisons for the company with 22, and we do anticipate the growth to come back in 23. The primary research that in talking to coaches, seeing kind of what are they seeing from a customer point of view, has been suggests that there's really no significant change in customer preferences. It was really a matter of people just wanting to enjoy life a little more, but the demand is there. One of the questions that comes up is that, you know, what is the cost of the program? It is not necessarily the cheapest. So if you do 5+1 program, the cost of the fuelings per month is about $400 a month. But if you're thinking about from a point of view of what does the food cost, given that you're replacing most of the meals during the month, and you're getting this support system that comes with the coach, the cost of that is actually not that high. So from a point of view of the affordability of the product, it's not the most affordable out there, but it is effective, and the coaches are helping you stay on the right path. So the value does seem to be there. Going through the inflection point checklist, I do think that all of the key items that we're looking for in an investing inflection point are there. We have underlying demand for product growth. We do have a catalyst, or I think there's catalyst there. And the sentiment on the company is clearly very negative, and I'll show that in a couple of slides. But you know, in terms of the key to our investment approach is not just finding a good company, but also figuring out how company makes money, but how company spends money. And one of the more wonderful things about the Medifast's business model is that it truly requires very little capital for growth. All of the growth that it has been experiencing in the past really comes from the point of view, the growth in the number of coaches. That cost is variable, as I discussed. And as far as the need to invest into capital equipment in order to support that growth, that is very little. The existing capacity, manufacturing capacity for fuelings that they have is good enough to up to $2.5 billion in sales, which company does have quite a bit of a runway from here. And also, in order to increase this capacity, we're talking about investment every 3-4 years of maybe $20, $30 million. So it's not significant compared to the amount of money that the company makes. So what does the company do with the cash it generates? It pays it back to shareholders. It pays it back to shareholders via dividends and buybacks whenever there is more cash being generated. As far as the dividend is concerned, this company has had a progressive dividend that has grown year over year over year. The current dividend yield is over 5%, which is very attractive on its own. But on top of that, since the company is generating quite a bit of money, and especially in years like 21, it's been buying back a lot of shares. So the number of shares that they bought since 2009, the number of shares outstanding is down by 25%, and it's down by 7% just in 2022 because the company is taking advantage of very low share prices. The management of the company has been consistent since 2016. So it's for 6-7 years at this point. And under the current CEO, Dan Char, the company has done very well, both operationally and for its shareholders. Sales up 150%, EBITDA is up 6 times. Dan has benefited from it himself because he's getting paid primarily through stock options. And as a result, he now owns over 1% of the company. And he has delivered to the shareholders very nice returns of 23% plus, even including last year's fairly heavy correction in the shares. Management incentives are based on revenues and operating income growth, which is it does make sense for this type of company. Company historically, because it's a MLM, it was always relatively cheap compared to where this high quality business growth usually trades, because market doesn't like those. So historically it trades at about 5% free cash flow yield, which for businesses growing 30% per year is pretty attractive to start with. But currently the level of valuation is beyond attractive, I would say. The free cash flow yield is 12%. This is 3 standard deviations away from relatively high historical averages to start with. The EV EBITDA of the company right now is 5.5, which is once again at the bottom of historical trading range. So from the point of view of the market expectations, I would say that they are as low as they've ever been for this company. Meanwhile, we do think that the growth for this company will come back, and the free cash flow is expected to grow by about 40% by our estimates over the next 2 years. So if we're starting from 12% now, you will get to high teens if the price does not change over the next 2 years. And what the company will do with that money is it will buy back more shares. From the point of view of where the company is valued, I already touched on most of that. The company is actually, so while MLM stocks are not particularly expensive, this one is, and I don't have a good explanation for it, is especially cheap right now. It's trading about 40% below peers on EV EBITDA basis. And if we just assume that the company comes back to peer EV EBITDA multiple, and I would argue that it deserves to trade at a higher multiple, but peer EV EBITDA multiple is 7 and does generate the type of revenue growth as I expect over the next few years, the returns on the stock should be 30% plus. We started this conversation from discussing the risks, the economic risks. So it's important to consider what happens to these type of companies if we do see a recession. And I wanted to bring up a couple of points why I think Medifast is positioned relatively well. First of all, direct selling models have done okay in past recessions. It's been a while since we had a real one, but in 2008, 2009, all of the direct selling companies that are publicly traded did show growth. Once again, that makes sense because you have people looking for ways to supplement their income. Through that, if you do that through direct selling, it's a relatively easy way to get involved. If there's more people trying to sell the product, they may have more success. So we saw Medifast experienced very strong growth throughout that period, and Herbalife and NuSkin is a cosmetic company, also experienced the growth. And NuSkin, we're talking about purely discretionary purchasing there. So even that did well in 2008, 2009 crisis. As I already mentioned, most of the costs for Medifast are variable. So if the sales do go down as a result of a very heavy recession, it should still remain profitable. And what makes it Medifast different from a lot of its peers is that it has no debt. It runs at net cash. So once again, if it doesn't experience difficulties, it has enough staying power to get to the other side of that. Summarizing the story, Medifast is a weight loss management company, and think it is especially well positioned for the current times. And I think that we're seeing a business inflection point that, if it does materialize, should deliver very strong returns to shareholders from here. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Steve, thank you so much for the presentation and the investment case you made here. For somebody who'd like to track the thesis over time, what would be the key data points to keep an eye on here?
The data point that I look at is the number of coaches, and that's something that they report quarterly. If the number of coaches is growing consistently, and let me go back to the chart so you can see what's been happening historically. So this is, so you can see on in the left chart that the number of coaches, and this is quarter over quarter change, historically goes up. Usually in Q3 and Q4 does not go up as much. It could be even down on quarter over quarter basis, but it usually does grow year over year. So that's the metric that to me is the key, because if people are joining the network as coaches, that will drive the growth for the company, because they're going to be selling the product. If you see that going away, so like one of the cases from the past, I think was Avon, where when I was looking at that company, the number of distributors was going down. And that to me was, no matter how cheap that stock gets, it just shows that it doesn't provide value for the people, for the stakeholders, not just shareholders, but for the stakeholders involved in the business. So if the number of coaches is growing, the company is going to be doing well. If the number of coaches starts falling and you don't have a good explanation for it, that would be an issue.
What would you say is the biggest long-term risk here to the thesis?
I think it's that. I think it's that for whatever reason, the number of that the people who are selling the product will move on. There are people who are saying that there might be risk from, because there are now some drugs that are coming out that would, I think there's one from LA Lilly that would, that is fairly effective against weight loss. But those are, I don't think they will take significant share of the market, because first of all, if you don't have insurance, they're a lot more expensive. And B, not a lot of people choose to medicate away their problems if they don't have to. So just like, they may take some share of the market, but I don't think it's going to just solve the problem with overweight and obesity in the United States. So from the point of view of the risks, I think that you could have just the value proposition go away. The company could mismanage their coaches if they decide to become more profitable at their expense. You could see that how that could become an issue. So to me, it's really more about execution and somewhat about competition. One thing that I did not mention, I don't know if I have a slide on it or not, but I think it does important to mention with this company, is that it is currently US only for all intents and purposes, North America. All of their sales are in US. Most of the other direct selling companies, including weight management companies like Herbalife and Weight Watchers, get majority of their sales from outside of the United States. The need to control the weight is just as high around the world as it is in the United States. They get 80, I think for Herbalife it's 70%, 75% of their sales are from outside of the United States. This is the market that has not been tapped by Medifast at all. And I do think that from a point of view of the potential of the company, eventually, once they do, they still have plenty of things to do in the United States, but I think they will at some point start growing outside. And that could also be a risk as well, whether they can execute that well. So that to me is another long-term risk.
Would you prioritize anything differently on the capital allocation side than the management is doing?
If they needed capital for growth, I would say that makes sense because of the high returns on invested capital that they're getting, but they don't. They have the existing manufacturing capacity, as already mentioned, is there enough to support growth for at least next couple of years. Maybe it makes sense for them to invest more into the coaches, to invest even more into the coaches by increasing those commissions and providing them the incentives. So maybe not so much from what we would see in the cash flow statement on the investing side, but on the operating side, it might make sense for them to lower their margins at some point in order to drive the size of the network and to create that virtuous circle. But the company has been fairly balanced from that point of view. And as a shareholder, I'm very happy that the company is spending all of its free cash flow on buybacks, but it's doing it at a 12% free cash flow yield.
Wonderful. Well, I will leave it there, Steve. Would just encourage MOI Global members to feel free to follow up with any further thoughts or questions. Once again, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again this year and share this investment thesis with the MOI Global community.
John, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Best wishes. Goodbye for now.